If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
The U.S. House prepares to vote on a massive climate, health care, and tax bill. Plus, American colleges and universities feel the pinch as Chinese enrollment numbers drop.
International students generally pay higher out-of-state tuition fees, which provides crucial funding to offset domestic declines and dwindling state funding at public universities.
And could Europe's drying rivers tip the continent into recession? It's Friday, August 12th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has said on his social media website that he will not oppose the release of court documents related to the FBI search of his Mar-a-Lago home in Florida this week. The Department of Justice had asked a Florida judge on Thursday to unseal the warrant used by the FBI, raising the prospect that the underlying reasons for the search could soon become public. News organizations had submitted court filings asking for the public release of the search warrant and related materials. Ultimately, that decision will be up to U.S. Magistrate Judge Bruce Reinhart, the South Florida judge who had originally approved the search warrant. The U.S. House of Representatives is set to pass Democrats' climate, health care, and tax package today and send it to President Joe Biden's desk. While far smaller than they had originally envisioned, House Democrats have largely united behind the bill, which is titled the Inflation Reduction Act, with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and leaders of the progressive and other wings of the party announcing their support. Republicans, meanwhile, have cast the bill as harmful government overreach, saying it would do little to tamp down on price increases. The de facto leader of Samsung, Lee Jae-yong, is due to receive a pardon on Monday, according to South Korea's presidential office. Lee, who goes by J.Y. Lee in the West, had twice been imprisoned for bribing the country's former president. Journal South Korea bureau chief Tim Martin says that Lee's legal reprieve from the South Korean president is underpinned by expectations it will help to propel the nation's economy. The reaction to the announcement has been mixed.
The reaction from business groups is satisfaction. They're happy J.Y. Lee can now resume much of his normal duties. He doesn't have to ask the government to travel overseas. He perhaps can even become chairman of Samsung sooner rather than later. At the same time, civic groups were upset. This is a story they've seen many times over the decades, where a business tycoon gets charged with a crime and then a president comes and wipes it away with a special pardon. These civic groups say that Korea prioritizes the economy over justice.
And electric vehicle startup Rivian Automotive says that its net loss in the second quarter nearly tripled to $1.7 billion. Those results further pressure Rivian to conserve cash and move quickly to fill customer orders. The company affirmed its 2022 production guidance of building 25,000 vehicles by the end of the year, but also forecast that its operating losses are expected to grow. Water levels in several of Europe's key rivers have fallen to critical lows as a result of scorching temperatures and a lack of rainfall. And the ripple effects of that are now being felt across supply chains and the European energy sector. Journal reporter Georgi Kontsev joins us now from Berlin with the very latest on this. Georgi, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So, Georgi, what is the situation across Europe right now?
Yeah, the situation is pretty dramatic. Ultimately, these rivers, they're formed the backbone of Europe's economy. And right now, we have critically low levels. On the other hand, the water is also pretty warm. And that is a pretty bad combination for industry, for energy companies. For example, in Germany, the Rhine, which is this obviously very important river for the industry here, the water levels on Wednesday evening, they were at 45 centimeters at this key choke point near Frankfurt. And that's roughly 50 centimeters lower than usual levels at this time of the year. and those levels expected to drop further by end of the week to 34 centimeters. That's a very important level. Under 40 centimeters, it's very difficult for most vessels to operate. So that will definitely hamper deliveries as well. And on the other hand, if you look at, you know, in France, then Switzerland, for example, as well, we have these warm waters. They've been hampering nuclear reactors because they need water to cool. So when the water is too hot, then they have to reduce output in those nuclear reactors. And then if you look towards the east, in Eastern Europe, the Danube, the main river there, the levels have also reduced as well. And that's hampering all kinds of transportation, including a very key Ukrainian grain route.
And so where is this situation leaving consumers? Where is it leaving businesses?
Absolutely, that's a key question. Usually, these things do happen. It's now more common in Europe to have rivers suffer these dry spells in the summer, and that's because of the warming climate. But this year, we also have, of course, the energy crisis in Europe because of the reduced gas deliveries from Russia. So the German government, for example, has decided to restart coal plants, and that coal needs to be transported to those plants, which a lot of that happens on the river from Amsterdam and other ports all the way down to Germany. So that will make the energy crunch even worse. That will mean also higher prices for consumers ultimately, because rivers across Europe are being used to transport everything from grains to oil to coal to minerals, all kinds of chemical products as well. So if those levels remain pretty low, then economists are saying that this might tip Germany for sure, but also potentially Europe into recession.
That was Journal reporter Georgi Kontchev joining us from Berlin. Georgi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, U.S. colleges and universities are set to welcome many fewer students from China to their campuses this fall. We'll look at the reasons for that and how this could affect those institutions after the break.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
The number of U.S. student visas issued to Chinese nationals plunged by more than 50% in the first half of this year compared to pre-pandemic levels. That is according to data from the U.S. State Department. Journal reporter Sha Hua joins us now from Singapore with a look at why fewer Chinese students are choosing U.S. colleges and universities and what that could mean for those institutions. Sha, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so fewer visas are being issued. I'd imagine that'll lead to a drop in enrollment. Why does this matter to U.S. institutions of higher education?
So international students generally pay higher out-of-state tuition fees, which provides crucial funding to offset domestic declines and dwindling state funding at public universities. In 2019-2020, before the pandemic depressed study abroad numbers, Chinese nationals accounted for roughly a third of foreigners studying in the U.S. and contributed about $60 billion in economic value, according to numbers by the Institute of International Education's Open Doors report.
And are all U.S. institutions of higher education affected equally when you see these enrollment numbers going down?
The drop seems to have hit big and small colleges and universities around the country, including state flagships. Just to give you an example, the University of Nebraska-Lincoln saw a drop of about 66% with their Chinese student enrollment numbers. And that is going to hit their revenues because in-state students pay up roughly $8,000 in tuition, whereas international students, out-of-state students, pay $25,000 in tuition.
Let's shift now to why we are seeing this. Can we put our finger on why enrollment is down for these Chinese students?
There are a mix of factors at play here. Travel restrictions and heightened safety concerns amid reports of gun violence and anti-Asian racism in the U.S. are definitely a major reason for this trend. In China, it's just the idea of getting into China, which is extremely costly and involves rigmarole of tests and enforced isolation at quarantine hotels that just put students off, and they just don't want to deal with a hassle. Education consultants have also told us that there's a flight to quality taking place. Back in the day, any U.S. degree would give you a leg up in China. Nowadays, Chinese employers and students have become more discerning. But even before the pandemic, Chinese students were shifting their sights already elsewhere driven mostly by better domestic and international alternatives, such as the UK or Singapore, and doubts about whether they'd feel welcome in the US.
And is being able to get a visa after graduation possibly an issue here as well?
That is definitely also a massive concern. And I think other countries such as the UK or Canada make it easier for students to stay on if they want to.
To what extent are these reasons that Chinese students are not enrolling in such high numbers in U.S. universities the result of policies enacted either by the U.S. or coming from China?
Many students that we've spoken to point to geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and China in general, and a presidential order by then-President Trump in 2020 specifically as something that influenced their decision where to study. The presidential order barred entry to the U.S. for Chinese graduate students and researchers with suspected ties to military-related entities. In practice, it seems that the visa clampdown has resulted in applications being rejected, even for those without clear military connections. While the Biden administration resumed visa processing for Chinese students in May 2021 after a hiatus that was pandemic-related, it left the ban in place and says it targets only approximately 1% of all students and scholar visa applications from China. Still, for many, the implementation of the ban comes across as arbitrary, and many Chinese students voice concern that they could become the next target of another ban. I should also say that Chinese state-run media has definitely leaned into depictions of the U.S. as a very chaotic place and amplified negative stories about racist incidences or what it portrays as the country's poor handling of the COVID pandemic. Meanwhile, China says that its own COVID controls are effective in curbing deaths, even if it comes at a high personal cost.
And finally, Shaw, what, if anything, are U.S. institutions or the U.S. government doing to try and attract back these students?
Universities are trying to recruit students, but it's made difficult by the fact that China still has very strict travel restrictions in place. A State Department spokesperson told us that the U.S. welcomes Chinese students and is committed to providing visa services. Secretary of State Antony Blinken stressed that the U.S. is open to Chinese students during a May speech where he laid out the Biden administration's approach to China, saying that we are thrilled that they've chosen to study in the U.S. and we are lucky to have them. Still, the education consultants and university administrators that we've talked to don't think the numbers for Chinese students will ever rebound to their peak levels again.
That was Journal reporter Sha Hua joining us from Singapore today. Sha, thank you so much for bringing us this story.
Thank you.
And finally, this week, Samsung released a pair of new foldable smartphones featuring flexible displays that bend in half. In a world in which most smartphones look the same, WSJ personal tech reporter Dalvin Brown says that phone makers see these new designs as a way to try and shake things up.
What smartphone makers are looking to do is break away from that and differentiate themselves from the competition. So analysts that I spoke to said that foldables may never overtake the bar-shaped smartphones we're all accustomed to today, but they do speak to something larger, which is just like creating more nimble screens or maybe even rollable screens that pull out from a device and allows you to sort of double the space of your phone without having to add a hinge to it. So they may never be as popular as the devices that we're familiar with today, but they are certainly picking up in popularity and a subset of consumers are noticing.
And that's What's News for Friday morning. We will be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening.